Welcome to Halal Money Matters, sponsored by Saturna Capital. I'm Monim Salam, and today we have a show about entrepreneurship. We have a very special guest who initially started off as a lawyer and then moved on, and she found out about their budding industry on hijabs, she kind of switched courses and really got into the business of hijab. And so really excited to have Melanie Alturk from Hot Hijab on our show. And really want to talk to her a lot and maybe get some insights as to what it takes to be able to start a business, keep it running, how to get funding, and those type of things. So I'm really excited. So let's get into it. All right. Thank you, Melanie, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was really, really good. I remember we met a long, long time ago. I was actually in Malaysia when we met, and you were, I think it was in the very, very early stages of you starting Hot Hijab. And so very exciting to hear what you were doing at the time and really kind of where it's come to now, mashallah. But I wanted to start off a little bit earlier than that, if you don't mind, and really tell us your journey, because you're a lawyer by training and by profession. So talk a little bit about that and how you kind of made the transition into what you're doing now.
Totally. Yeah. So the law was really my career path and my first passion, just in terms of social justice, civil rights. I was raised an activist, and so law was like the natural progression for me. But there was always something inside of me that was tugging at me around fashion, always since way before I even knew what civil rights even meant. And so many lawyers are like this. Their left and right brain are both active. And in the law, when you're not using the creative kind of part of you, you feel a little stagnant. Yeah. And so I just had this idea of like, you know what? I've got some time on my hands. I had just gotten married. I'm no longer married, but I just gotten married and I was looking for a job, and it was like, all right, I've got some time. Let me just start something. And so, you know, HH was born. And from there, I was able to kind of juggle both careers. And when I met you, I was working at the DIFC courts in Dubai, yeah. But I was running HH with my ex-husband on the side. So it was always kind of in tandem until I finally had to leave the law behind because the company just got so big that it was like, you got to pick one now. Yeah. And that was in 2016 when we then decided to move from Dubai to New York City and run the company full time. And that was, I never looked back after that.
So you were one of the early adopters as well in the fashion, in the modest fashion industry, correct? It was like, I think when we were talking, at least there was hardly anybody in the space. And now it's become pretty much every woman that's out there has something out of her garage she's trying to sell.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. And I love that. I think that's awesome. But yeah, we started in 2010. So certainly one of the early adopters for sure. Yeah.
And then what was there challenges there as well?
Back in 2010 when we just started? I mean, sure. It's new. Everything new is challenging in some way in that you have to pave your own path and figure it out for yourself. You know, with the legal career, I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that I had a passion for it. Yeah. And that's the thing. When you follow your passionate pursuits, the way finds itself, the path finds itself. And it was just like one step after the other, after the other, after the other. And things just became clearer and clearer as we kept moving forward. I never dreamed that we'd get this far. Mm. I never dreamed.
Did you always think it was a side gig for you?
Yes, from the start, for sure, because I was still very much invested in my legal career. And even while I was in Dubai, they were grooming me to become a judge.
Oh. So,
yeah, I was very invested in that part of my life. And then, like I said, it got to a point where I had to really make a decision. I prayed istikhara and I was like, okay, it sounds like what I'm going to do. You know, there's so many lawyers in the world and do really good work, but how many people are doing what I'm doing right now? And at that time, there weren't many. And I knew that I had a unique voice when it came to the modest fashion space. I had a knack for it from a very practical fashion perspective, mm-hmm. but also just my background with social justice and being very, very firm on the fact that I wanted this to be about lifting up Muslim women who choose to wear hijab. Like
Yeah,
the
so now
pro
that's a good point. So let's talk about that. So how do you define modest fashion?
Oh gosh, that's such a vague term. Modest fashion to me is just however one chooses to dress themselves in a way that does not comply with society's standards of beauty today, which unfortunately are not very modest. And so whatever that looks like, I remember in the very early days, there were a lot of like Orthodox Jewish brands also that kind of coupled up with like Muslim fashion brands because we all had the same mission, providing an alternative for women. So whether you covered your hair or you didn't, some women just wanted more coverage when it came to their clothing. Obviously, we're a hijab brand, so for us, it's very specific and tailored to the hijab. But you know, I think it's just like the alternative to a woman who doesn't want to dress like the way mainstream tells you to dress and what's available in most stores. You know, it's summertime now. If you go to the mall, it's really hard to, as a woman who wears hijab, to find clothing that's lightweight, perfect for summer, but also still covers up. So there's still very much a need.
That's a really good point, and I think, and I haven't lived in the Middle East, but when I was in Malaysia, I mean, they really do have an industry for that. It's a very humid climate, but pretty much throughout the year it stays that way, and so they really have kind of grown that industry organically to a point now, which that is even in conventional stores, if you want to call them. Like the local department stores and stuff like that, they have just a line of hijabs or a line of modest dressing and that type of thing, which is something that I don't think was there prior to. And but do you find this is more of a of what you're trying to do, more of a Western Muslim minority issue, or is it pretty much all over the world?
Great point. I should have caveated that when I was giving my example. You know, as an American Muslim woman, these are my challenges. And so that extends to other Muslim women in Western countries. But certainly, like you said, in Malaysia and other parts of Southeast Asia and the Middle East, you won't have such an issue. And so it kind of depends on where you live and what your needs are and whether or not, you know, the clothing that you need is readily available to you. But what we're trying to build is global. So, like, I come at it from a very unique perspective in that I'm an American Muslim, but having lived in the Middle East for 4 years, you know, and just my background ethnicity-wise, I have a really unique view of, you know, like, what are the needs? What do for overseas, you know, those places that I just mentioned, the problem isn't necessarily availability, the problem is quality. So each market has its own specialized needs that as we move and expand into different markets, we're able to discern like, okay, for them, it's not so much the messaging and the storytelling of like, hey, preserve your identity, be confident in hijab. It's more so like, yo, stop buying these 10 dirham hijabs off the street.
That's true. That's true. And so let's kind of go back again. No, you basically started this as a side project. Was it basically self-funded at the time?
Yeah, we got initially like $5,000 from my in-laws, God bless them. And that was like our seed money to just start going. We started off of that. And from there, I was able, I'm from Detroit. And there's one thing we know how to do, it's hustle. So I was like, I got to make this $5,000 like last. What we did was I would go to the thrift stores. And I would source vintage scarves and I'd start putting them up on the website before we officially launched because we were launching as a clothing brand at that time. And that was just to bring money in. We'd make like $800, $1,000 a week on that. And that was what paid the designer that I brought on to help me create and produce that very first collection of clothing.
So literally, like thrift stores, you're going there, you're kind of picking out scarves, you're putting in on the on website, and people are buying them. And you're like, wow, I can't believe people are buying the stuff. Is that what it was? Or you knew there was
No,
something
I
there?
was shook. I had no idea. At every turn of this company, I'm always in awe of like, wow, people are, they're actually loving this. I didn't know what the response would be. I mean, I knew I loved thrifting, but I don't know if anyone else would care about that. But I think because, again, it was such a novel idea and it was so difficult to find hijabs that were beautiful. And, I did a good job of sourcing like different unique pieces that people had never seen or even thought to wear a vintage scarf as a hijab. At the time, that wasn't a thing.
That's true. So moving on, then you now you're at the point, obviously sales are increasing to the point you're like, oh my God, I can't do both of these things at the same time. So then now you're coming to the decision of do I leave my job and go do this full time, or what was the other alternative? Was it like you would sell this, or what were you thinking?
Gosh, there were so many times where we tried to sell the brand even before we moved to Dubai, because all my operations were in Chicago where we started. We were like, maybe we should try and sell this thing. I don't know how we're going to keep this up in Dubai. Didn't pan out. And so I just got to Dubai and I hit the markets and I just took a cab. And I'm like, take me to your garment district. I know there's one. And the dude's like, I know exactly the place. And he just drove and dropped me off. And I just explored. And then it's like what I was saying earlier, the path just finds itself when you have that will to figure something out. And I didn't know what to do, where to start, how to pr start producing, because again, all my production was in Chicago. And we just started again. And then, there was another time in the company where things were really dire and it was like, should we sell the business? And then God finds another way for us. Like, that's been our story.
That's
At
awesome.
every juncture, I'm like, God, I'm good. He's like, you're not done yet. And I'm like, okay,
You
I'll
got to
keep
keep pushing forward. That's
going.
right.
Yes, it's the story of my life with this company.
So now that it is a global brand, and you're looking back at it and you're talking about all of these challenges, like how did you think about funding and scaling? Like, well, how did you balance between, okay, how do I grow this on an equity basis? Do I do it on from a loan perspective from a bank? Like, what were some thoughts you were having in your mind going through that?
And in those early days, I was so in over my head. Finance was not my forte. It was not something that I understood at all. And I leaned heavily on my co-founder with the finance piece. Now, that said, if I could go back, I would do so much differently. But I'll tell you what we did do, which was we moved to New York City. And
Which
the
is like
reason.
a really expensive place. Well, I guess Dubai is pretty expensive as well, but
No, New York blows it out of the
oh, does
water.
it? Okay. Especially the garment industry, I guess that's where I guess
Everything.
in Dubai you can go and still get things made for cheaper, but in New York is New York. You can't,
Totally. We did not move our production. So
Oh,
everything
okay.
in the UAE till today, our factory out in the UAE is still intact.
Okay.
But what happened was while we were in Dubai, we had investor interest from a VC located in New York City. We had never really considered a VC in terms of funding the company that way. But because they were reaching out to us, we were like, okay, certainly we have something on our hands. So we flew out to meet with them. Things looked good. It just felt like this was the next natural step. So my ex-husband at the time, he was already itching to leave Dubai. I was not. I was like, yo, I've got a great job. I'm about to be a judge. Like, I'm good. Life just moved me in a different direction. So when we moved out here, we did get a term sheet from that VC. It sucked. There was no actual money they were giving us. It was all in kind. That was like we got to use their office and they were trying to set up this factory in like Latin America somewhere. Somewhere in Central America. I can't remember where, but it was awful. But what did we know? We didn't know anything. Like, thank God we had people to turn to like you. I talked to you about it. I talked to so many people about it and they were like, don't do this. This is an awful term sheet. And we were like, oh, okay. So we turned that down. And then that next 8 months to a year, we just hit the pavement to find investors. And it was some, one of the, it was like of the most stressful times in the company's history because we didn't know how we were going to survive. Just personally, like if we'd be able to pay rent because this company was all we had. We both quit our jobs to do this full time.
And I think through that struggle, I think you begin to learn and really kind of appreciate, looking back, obviously that time that was there was so basically hard, but actually you grew from that much more, I guess, right? So,
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I learned how to fundraise. I learned how to properly network. I learned so much. And it's so funny because those skills that I picked up, I don't even use anymore today because like I said, I don't know. I don't think that the VC world is made for a company like ours.
Well, I mean, I think like, the important thing people don't realize is that like VCs are there for one purpose, and that's just to make money.
Right.
So, and so, you know, a lot of times when people think, "Oh, I'm getting this money," the other side of that is you're going to be doing less of your work and more about reporting to them exactly what you're doing.
That's
And
right.
because they control you, they're going to be dictating to you what it is you're going to be doing in your business. And
That's right.
so, I mean, I think when we had the conversation, that's I think I find I remember clearly that's what I was telling you is like, if you want to sell your company's soul to a VC, go for it, right? But it's not for everybody. A lot of
Yeah.
people want to be able to keep that soul of the company, the direction, those type of things there.
Right. And that's where we got derailed. Like we were able to raise a first pre-seed round in that 8 months. We raised, I think, 600,000, and then we did a seed round where we raised 2.3 million, and we went on to do some other subsequent smaller rounds. But in that time, when we had very involved investors, as you said, the soul of the company got lost as the priorities had changed, unfortunately. And I have so many, I mean, I don't know if I'd call them regrets because it's lessons learned, but like I said, if I could go back, I would not do it that way. And I wouldn't recommend that to somebody with a business like mine. You know, at the end of the day, Silicon Valley is about tech companies. We're not a tech company. It never made sense for us, but it was just kind of like what was happening in the time. It was like in the zeitgeist, like you go get funding from VC. So many VCs were cropping up just trying to like, you know, be part of that life. And it, like I said, no regrets because with that funding, we were able to really catapult our brand.
So that, so, but you eventually did get VC funding, or was it still family and friends that you were
Oh,
the
from
second?
that first round, that was VC funding.
Okay. So
From
you
investors.
started off with family and friends, like you mentioned, your ex-husband's
Sure.
parents were did it, and then along the way, basically you're self-funding just based on sales and those type of things, and then you had this offer for this VC was not really giving you anything, so more like an incubator than a VC. Basically, they would give you services for free, like rent, and you know they would have you unpaid rent, you know those type of things. But then when you went out and did the round, it was more venture capital.
Yeah, that first 600,000 was led by Arlen Hamilton of God, that's awful that I'm forgetting these names.
That's fine. Not a
But
big deal.
her VC, she was the very first yes we ever had. She put in 50K,
That's
and that
great.
was wild to us that someone finally said yes after pounding the pavement for months. So that first round was led by VC, and then the second round was all VCs.
And is it was it more
They have.
what the, was the round drawn on your idea, or did they want financial statements and everything like right in that step? And you
In
said
the
you're not you don't have a financial background, so how did you come up with that?
right, in the very beginning with that first 600,000, we were still able to provide statements and do the diligence they wanted, but it was far less involved than our seed round. Our seed round got really, really, really involved because you're millions of dollars. We had like five or six VCs come in. We raised 2.3 million, all VCs, and it was very intense. Yeah, it was such a wild time. It was a wild ride. But yeah, I learned so much from that situation because you learn who the players are, who eats who. You know, like what people are really about. You learn a lot. I learned so much about just people also. You know, like one face they would show you and then they'd turn around
Different.
and show you something different. It was just, I came in so green, so naive. Like I don't operate that way. So for me to be kind of thrust into this industry was really eye-opening for me. Now, put me in, you know, a room full of sharks, I'll do just fine. Again, I'm from Detroit. I know how to handle myself, but I wasn't prepared for what was to come. It was just a lot. It was a crazy time.
That's true. And so now that you have, you can look back on it and do that. Like, what advice would you have for aspiring entrepreneurs? Like on the financial side, like what are some pitfalls to avoid? What are some things you definitely would be a yes or no, those type of things? What would you?
Here's one thing that I think about, and for you and your background, help walk me through this. But if the purpose, I had a real existential like crisis in my mind of like, all right, well, as Muslims, we stay away from interest, right? Cool. And we do this because interest is exploitative and we're not meant to exploit people and we're not meant to be exploited. Cool. Well, taking a bank loan on interest versus giving someone a huge chunk of my company for little to nothing in return, to me sounds pretty exploitative. If not more so, because ultimately you'll pay off that bank loan.
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah, maybe.
I mean, they could destroy you.
That's also true. But it just felt to me like, what's the real answer here? Because the reason why we were being so pushed into the investor route was because of this need to avoid usury and interest and riba. Now, if I could go back, would I do it that way? Like, no regrets. I'm glad that I did it that way. But I don't know if that's the right way. I don't know if, and speaking very candidly and frankly, in the last, like, since COVID hit, especially since 2022, COVID was a good time for us because of, the e-com boom that happened in 2020, 2021. It slowed down at the latter half of 22. Then we hit some real hard times because investors ran dry, like they were not shelling out money. Even though there's a lot of dry powder out there, like they just weren't investing, and they certainly weren't investing in my vertical. It was very much like a wait and see approach from a lot of the VCs. So then at that point, we were like, okay, well, how are we going to sustain ourselves? Because we had, that's the other thing of taking on that much money. You grow so big because you feel like you have access to unlimited capital, and then your operating expenses far outweigh your revenue that's coming in. So we weren't profitable and we have to make ends meet. So we take on some term loans. We also engage a inventory financing entity. Basically they pay our POs and it's kind of like a revolving line of credit. Oh my God, this was a whole other era of financing for the company that it's like you can't win. Like either way, you're dealing with sharks and you're dealing with really murky situations finance-wise. So to answer your question, what I would say to any entrepreneur is focus on profitability. You have to self-sustain yourself. And if you can't get there because your margins aren't right or the product is not connecting, if you need to pivot. Because if you can't self-sustain yourself, relying on outside funding it's not a route that you
The
should
death
take.
trap.
It's a death trap.
It's interesting that historically business has always been there, even small mom and pop shops or whatever it is. There always was, how do I get to profitability as soon as possible, right? And then what happened was is that there was a shift along the way, and part of it has to do with zero interest rates, which is basically people were like, there's free money out there, might as well just take it. And free from the interest perspective, it's free. But from everything else that happens, they're not free, right? So then it became more a matter of, okay, how many hijabs am I selling, rather than am I profitable? Is it how many factories can I produce to be able to sell those hijabs, and what is going to make the profitability went out the window because they kept pushing it down the road. You'll get there in 10 years, then you get there 15 years and 20 years, and that's where you get into trouble when all the money dries up.
They don't care if you die in the meantime because they've invested in 50 companies and they only expect one to survive anyway. They're counting on that unicorn that's going to give them back their returns. So they don't even care if you live or die. Yeah, it's a really cutthroat game that
So
they
did you
play.
buy them out? Are you done, or you're still kind of in the trail?
Pray for me, not yet. Goal. And in fact, right now I'm at a point to be like completely transparent where financially we have to figure something out, whether that's like a recap where everyone, the entire cap table just gets wiped out and we start fresh, or what, I don't know. I mean, I am actively fundraising. Like I've also kind of burned a lot of VC bridges just because I've been so vocal with what's happening in Palestine since, everything popped off. I don't have to say more, right? It's like you kind of get blackballed, and then it's like, all right, you're done here, which is probably to my benefit, to be honest. So I've been going, trying to reach out to a lot of family funds, a lot of like high net worth Muslims. But again, there's this disconnect with the finances in our community, unfortunately. And in our community, it's like we'd rather donate all this money we have than invest in a company because that's safer for us. We know what that is. We know what that looks like. But when you come to me with this term sheet and ask me for this money to invest in your company, like I'm in over my head, you know, like we're doctors and lawyers and engineers. Like we're not like you, right? Like your background.
Well, it's hard to compete with 700 times 700x return, so which is promised in the Quran. So like that part of it's there. That's going to be there. But I do think that now more than ever, you do have a lot more wealthier Muslims that are willing to take on. Maybe some investments within the different VC space or the private equity space. The problem is we're not a mature industry yet, and there's no, like, you don't know exactly where to go to find them, right? That's where the disconnect is happening, from just the industry perspective. But I do think that's happening more and more. I'm beginning to see more and more funds that are being started that actually are funding businesses like yours or others, the others that are there, because you're no longer in the VC phase. You're more of a private equity, mezzanine
Yes.
finance, that type of thing. So,
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's something that's been slowly kind of germinating over in the community. I think that'll continue to do that.
I'm happy to hear that because, you know, ultimately, one of my goals of this company was beyond the hijabs, beyond the community we're building, it is to create wealth for our ummah. Because if I can create wealthy individuals, if I can do so well with the business and then pour that wealth into the community, then it becomes like this great cycle. And that's why I'm here. That's why, you know, why I want to elevate our ummah. We have so much to do. And so I'm happy to hear that because everybody plays their part. And I think the more that we can fund ourselves from within, I mean, if we've learned anything in these last couple of years, it's that we need to unify ourselves as an ummah and help each other instead of going outside to, you know, like beg other people, whether it's financially or what have you. And the problem is, I think for so long, it was like dog eat dog within the Muslim world because we felt like we were competing with each other for these outside resources outside of our community. Because there's only so many hijab brands that are going to get funded, right? There's only so many, you know, like Muslim doctors who are going to be the head of the hospital. And so it became this dog eat dog type of like culture we had created. Correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but I felt it certainly in my space when I'm like, there's room for all of us. There's enough for everybody to eat. There's enough air for all the butterflies. Like, you guys, we need to think about this differently. Like, Allah's infinite. He's like, his abundance is infinite. So if we can take on that mindset and within help each other out, we'll thrive.
Well, I
Like,
think the issue is in a small industry that's beginning to grow, where you don't know what eventually the market size will be. It becomes that way. It becomes a competition to do that. But once the actual industry matures and you realize, well, there are more studies done and those type of things, and people are like, wow, this is actually a much larger industry than we thought it was going to be, then you begin to kind of ease off a little bit on the competition and more of the collaboration that's actually there. Which brings up a good point. Did you ever look for outside US funding when you were doing that, like for the factory in Dubai or other
I
places?
did. I did. I fundraised a lot in the UAE and we had a lot of really good meetings with a handful of VCs out there. But ultimately, I don't think we, again, it's like because we were a Muslim company doing hijabs for them, it like wasn't sexy enough, if that makes sense. Like they wanted to be in with the big boys, like in Silicon Valley, and they weren't investing in stuff like us, even though like all of our funding came from American VCs. That would give us a like that would pique their interest and be like, oh, this Silicon Valley VC invested in you. Like, let me look at your deck. But they wanted to fill their portfolio with like other things. And that became really clear that we were like, we're just not what they're looking for. But But there is a lot of money out there. I will also say though that they're very like they're not as sophisticated as the VCs out here too. So I also kind of feel like it was a blessing because I do have friends that were funded by some VCs out there, and oh gosh, their ending was just like awful, just awful, awful. The way that they would just like yeah. So I ultimately
Well,
I think.
also, it's, you know, a lot of the VCs are either government backed or government run, and if you part terms, they can literally destroy you, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know,
Yeah.
so so you're
And
not
usually
only married to
for
them for life, you're married to them for life and the
Oh.
hereafter, you know. So, but
Yeah.
yeah, that's so true. And then and so and then again now. Looking at it from the perspective of, again, going back and like looking at it from the industry, I mean, you know, you have competition that had come in, and the competition actually, what I would argue, would actually has grown the industry more than it has kind of, you know, taken part. It's not a zero-sum game. In fact, the more people players come in, usually it actually expands the market because more people get to learn about and say, yeah, I would like to do that as well, you know, those type of things. Has there been more of a collaborative effort going on in the industry now, or is it still pretty much
No,
very
everyone does their own thing for the most part. I think there's a collaborative effort outside of it. Okay, like let's say there's two Muslim brands, but they have completely different product to sell, but to the same type of customer. You'll see some cooperation there, but amongst the actual brands themselves, I haven't seen that. Not to say that we shouldn't or anything. I just haven't. I think there was a time, like back when I had met you, there were like modest fashion forums, and there were a lot of places where we were meeting all in one place. And it was really cool because all these founders got to come together and kind of share their woes. And we got to talk to the founders of, you know, Modenisa and Aab out of the UK and meet all these really cool people doing cool stuff in different places of the world. And that allowed a really cool collaborative initiative just among founders of like, hey, let's share our stories. I would say here in America, I don't see that too much, but I also have to admit I'm in my own little bubble. Like I just am hyper focused on what I'm doing.
I don't think you have any major competition in America, if I would say. I mean, a lot, like I said, there's the moms and the wives maybe, or the daughters that are out of the garage selling it, but I haven't seen any other brand like your brand in the U.S. You can, you know, Modernista and other ones in Turkey and stuff. You can call it global brands, but in the U.S., I haven't seen anything else. So maybe a
Yeah,
little different. So.
agreed. And that's probably why.
Yeah, maybe that's why you're in bubble. That's right. You know,
Cool.
that's true.
Yeah.
But that is something that is there, from the, and then did you find, you know, when Nike came up with their brand, and then you found also other larger brands, you know, maybe trying to come into the space. Did you see that a moment of when we've made it, or was it a moment of, oh, if they can do it, they might be able to destroy me?
Oh, never did I think they'd be able to destroy us, but I did. It was like equal parts. This is so cool, like so awesome, and then equal parts feeling like let's talk about Banana Republic for a second. Like they came out with a line of hijabs. The way that it was advertised was not by any means in line with like what hijab is to be. And so I took issue with that because as a corporation, like be responsible if you call it a head wrap. But if you're going to call this a hijab, which it has religious significance, then respect it. So it was equal parts like, this is awesome. Like finally, these mainstream brands are acknowledging us. But then equal parts like, wait, but should we be getting so excited about this? Because clearly, this is just a money grab. Clearly, they just know that our pockets are deep and we have a real need for this product. So I was like weary and excited at the same time and like optimistic, but also like, hey,
And I
a
do think
lot.
that over the years, you know, as this idea of modest fashion, particularly in the case of hijab, has come out, I've seen this in my kids and other people as well. There has been a redefinition of
Yeah.
what hijab really means,
That's true.
right? And
Yeah.
so, what hijab meant in the 90s is not different than what it was in the noughts. and different when it was 10 years ago, and even now. And I think it's become looser. And are you saying that's because of these corporate brands coming in?
No, definitely not. I'm not
Okay.
saying because of that whatsoever. It's just the trend of the times. It's like
Okay.
you said, like things ebb and flow. We have times where we're far more conservative or times where we're far more liberal. Like if you look at pictures of our parents in the 70s, like they were really liberal in how they dressed and you know what I'm saying? And then things got more conservative towards the 80s and 90s. And then, like now we're seeing that's just the ebb and flow of
Yeah.
life and like our ummah. It's always going to be like that.
That's true. And
And I
when
also, if I can just add to that point, I don't think it was these mainstream brands coming in. I think it was social media and a whole bunch of like influencers who wore hijab showing women like there's more than one way to wear hijab. And I'm not going to keep myself away from the hijab because I'm not wearing it the way you tell me I should wear it, which I think is really beautiful because no two women are going to wear it the same. And wherever, whatever level she's at in terms of her own iman and her own belief, like let her express that for whatever that looks like for her. We're all on this journey together. And it's going to look different for each of us. So I actually really celebrate that because
That's great.
it's not a zero sum game with hijab either. Like either you wear it this way or you're not hijabi.
Mm.
What was the 90s understanding of hijab? It was like either it looks like this or it's not hijab.
Yeah.
And I took issue with that because I didn't wear it that way.
Yeah.
I would be in spaces where I felt really judged because I was wearing pants or like whatever, right?
Or even a colorful. I remember the 90s was all either black or white. And so if you wore a colorful, you were like, oh my God, what is this?
Exactly. And so I think I love the fact that today you can see so many different arrays of styles and ways to wear it, but it's all in the name of like, hey, this is where I'm at, and this is what hijab looks like for me right now. And I love that.
Yeah, that's true. And one other thing I was going to go back to, if we can go back to the VC part of it, and we talked about this idea of, zero rates and free money and what you actually get for it, and then businesses being profitable. The other point that I wanted to make was is that a lot of, again, businesses, it traditionally has always been about, okay, how do I make money, right? And then it became a matter of how do I get to a point where I can get bought out. Right. And then that became the kind of, even now, a lot of times in Silicon Valley, that's what it's about. You're not really creating a product. You're creating a part of a product that could fit into a bigger hole for the larger companies that are there.
Correct.
When you're thinking about your business, does that thought come to your mind as well? Is it like, how do I exit this thing? Or is that, no, I'm blinders on. I'm just going to go as fast as I can to where we are. And what would you recommend for other people when if they want to get an entrepreneur, women entrepreneurs?
On what you want. Like for some people, it is about starting something that they can sell. Cool. It really depends on your preference and what you're trying to build and for what reason. For me, I want this to be a privately held company that long outlives myself, that can have the longevity of a fashion brand, the way we've seen Ralph Lauren or a Chanel, like a fashion house that can continue even after the founder is long gone. And so for me, it's never been about like, hey, let's make ramp this up as much as we can, make as much profit as we can, and then go out and sell this thing and make a bunch of money off of it. No, it's like, let's carefully curate a brand that will last the test of time because this is meant to go on for ages in order to serve the Muslim community, whatever that looks like at the time, and her needs as a hijab wearing woman. And so for me personally, like my specific plans is I have to get through this like financial hump I'm in right now and then laser focus on profitability. We were profitable in 2023 and then October 7th hit. And after that, our community was like, I mean, I couldn't go on social and advertise the way I typically did. It just wasn't the time for that stuff. And so our revenue took a hit and then there goes our profitability. Like we finally got there and it was and then, alhamdulillah, like it is what it is. And but like I said, right now it's like, all right, get over this financial hump I'm in right now, laser focus on profitability, self-sustain ourselves, continue to expand and grow intentionally. I'm not trying to go as fast as I can. I did that before. I crashed and burned. What I'm trying to do is build intentionally, even if that's slow. Be very strategic about your next steps because this is a marathon. This isn't a sprint. Like, From now until, the time when I'm too old to run this thing anymore, I have many visions in terms of like having actual retail stores in different areas of the world. And it takes time to build in that way that is sustainable. Because I really believe in the third law of physics. Every action has an equal opposite reaction. And the higher and faster you go, then expect that drop to be just as fast. And we see that so many times in this space. Like something becomes so trendy, it becomes everybody's talking about it. It's just this like buzz brand. And
Fast
then,
fashion, right? Basically, you have to kind of keep up with the latest.
and then the next day it's like nobody cares about it anymore. And that is not what I'm trying to build. What I want, I'm building something evergreen that stands for something. You know what it is, high quality, you can rely on it. It's like Ralph Lauren is probably the best example I can use. You know what Ralph Lauren is. It's not going anywhere. When you want those high quality pieces that are staples in your closet, you go and you know what to expect and you get it. That's exactly what I'm doing, of like, this is what it is, come and get it. Even from a marketing perspective, I mean, the amount of money people throw into Google and Meta because they've convinced you that you need to pay them to grow your brand, to me is such a fallacy. If you can't do this by word of mouth organically, you don't have a good brand. Your product is not connecting if you have to rely on paid ads. Sure, like I'm not saying don't engage in it at all, but if that's how you're making your money, and if you turn off your ads, your business would go under, you don't have a good business. That's what I mean in terms of sustainability. You have to make sure that you have a product that connects and that you can actually make money off of it. And if so, great, you've got a good thing going. Then decide for yourself. You were asking like, what advice would I give? Decide for yourself, what do you want? You want to be in this thing for the long haul? Or do you want to build your brand, get to that place where you're profitable, and now go out when you're in a position of strength and try and sell this thing? Up to you, and your own commitment. For me, my commitment is way beyond the physical hijab. It's about, as I said, creating wealth for our community. It's about elevating the Muslim community. It's about having a platform where my voice can be heard and the voices of others. So, like, I'm in this for the long haul, that's for sure.
That's great, mashallah. And then the other thing I was going to talking about profitability, I mean, as you know, in the fashion world, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens to make yourself profitable, which is, the slave labor or those type of things. How do you balance the two together? I'm not saying that was extreme. I was giving about the Chinese labor and stuff like that, or even in Bangladesh, what happened, in the last decade, what happened there with the fires. But how do you balance between that, and how do you keep to your core principles as a business? Say, no, I'm never going to do this. This is something we're never going to do. And how do you stay to that focus?
Sure. And again, this is where the social justice, civil rights background comes in. Because when I first started, every SLA I ever created had terms in there about working conditions, about part-time, full-time, overtime pay, like making sure, that things were not just to their standard of their factory, to my standard.
So just for the audience purposes, what's SLA?
It is a service.
Service level agreement. I just want to make sure. I just want. Okay.
Service level
Let
agreement.
me ask the question again. Let me ask so that you can answer. So just for the audience purposes, what is an SLA?
It's a service level agreement, basically the contract that you're getting into with your vendors, your warehouse, your factories. And so because I had that very strong background and I was very firm about this, like when I would approach someone, let's say to start producing for me, that's the first conversation I have. I say, look, I do things by the book. I'm very straight. I'm very clean. I don't cut corners and I don't do anything shady. If that sounds good to you, we'll have a nice working relationship. If that's not you, then let's part ways now. I don't want to waste your time. I don't want to waste mine. And from there, you establish, like, they know exactly who you are and you don't mess around. And then, like I said, I put those terms in the SLA to make sure we're all on the same page. Now, for us, you asked about profitability. Look, it's all about, like, you have to know your margins and how much you need to make to survive. And if that means that your product has to be at a price that makes you cringe a little because you're like, oh man, Muslims are cheap, get over it. Like, get over it. When we first started, our brand was considered very expensive. Now, why is that? Because we were used to paying next to nothing for our hijabs. But like, how does it make sense that you're paying hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars, for the purse you're wearing? But we won't pay $20 for a hijab. Like, I don't get that. Like, put some value into this thing on that is such a sacred garment you're wearing. So to me, it felt like, all right, this is going to be an uphill battle for us, but this is a worthy one. We have to shift the mindset of the community to consider putting something of higher quality on their head that is going to cost more, because I don't sacrifice on quality. That's the reason we've stayed around this long. It's the reason why when we turn off our ads, we can sustain ourselves. Why, if I don't go on social for 2 weeks, we sustain ourselves. I don't have to rely on marketing tactics to survive because the product sells itself. And in that is a quality product that people know that they're going to get something that'll last and that will be up to, like their requirements. I'm such a stickler on that because that's how I live. I cannot wear something that isn't of high quality. I can't explain it. Like, it just, I can't. And so because I live by that, that's how I run the company.
So it's really
And
about really figuring out your price point for profitability. And really
exactly.
just saying, this is the brand, this is the quality I want to stick with, and not
Right.
moving down on the quality.
But you don't cut corners at the production phase. You don't cut corners at the people who are making your product. Like, their hands are literally making your product. It better be infused with equity and fairness and love. That is the product that then is going to get moved to your customers' hands. So the cutting corners, like, you cannot cut corners there. And then once that finished product goes to your customer, whatever price you need to sell it at to keep your business afloat, you have to sell it. And if that means that it's too expensive, then, like, look for different, I don't know, like
Partners, yeah. I mean,
different
we
partners.
look for different partners,
Right. Or just trust that the right customer will find you. Like, that's what I had to do. I had to just trust that, like, look, I know this is expensive. I pay for it. So there must be other women out there like me. And alhamdulillah, I was right. So.
That's good. Any final thoughts? I really appreciate all of the advice. So, any final thoughts you'd want to give to on the financial side of what did doing what you did. And what's in for the future for you?
Final thoughts, I would say this, because looking back on the finance side, the places in my heart where I look back and I'm like, ugh, was whenever I compromised the brand for our investors. Like, how could I have allowed that? How could I have this baby, this thing that I built so carefully from the ground up? How could I have lost sight of the customer and the community and what and me and my own reason for doing this because I was trying to please an investor? Like, that to me is something that was a very important and valuable lesson. So stay true to your intentions, write them down, revisit them often, and know why you're doing this. And it is so easy. I mean, I was just talking about this with my team. Like, it's a hijab brand. You're doing something quote unquote righteous, but you can get caught up chasing dunya while convincing yourself you're chasing akhirah, truly.
True.
And I had to take a long, hard look and pause and like be like, like, we got to stop because I have to reassess. And if I keep going in this direction, there will be no barakah in our company. And so, like, if you truly rely and trust in Allah to continue to purify your intentions, to keep you on that right track, and to bring to you the good people that he loves to help sustain you, it will happen. But when you take it into your own hands and you think, no, it's my hands that have to build this thing, and then you get into that matrix of consumerism and capitalism that America instills in us since birth, it will not end well for you. And I can testify to that. And I thank God because in many instances, we could have crashed and burned for good, but Allah always gave us a lifeline. I believe it's because I've always tried to be sincere. And when I've gotten off track, I've been like, Allah, please bring me back. Like, if and when I get off track, please bring me
Bring back.
back. And He does.
And
So,
sometimes those are painful lessons, but in the long run, it actually works out to be better, right? It's like,
alhamdulillah.
alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. So as we leave, what do you think is next for the just your industry in general and specifically for Hotjar jobs as well?
You know, as we're coming out of a really turbulent, tough time, it's been one tough thing after the other, I would say, since 2020 for us on a personal level and for us as a collective, as Muslims, and also just in the world. We, I believe, are going to come into some sort of renaissance. I can already feel it, where creativity is going to burst at the seams because we have so much pent-up energy, especially creatives, because we haven't been able to express ourselves fully, literally since COVID. All the plans we had, you know, pre-COVID, like, just kind of went to the back burner, and we've never been able to catch up. Now, I'm not saying we'll go back to those plans because the world has changed. I don't think we should. But what will be true is there is going to be a creative explosion. And I think it's a beautiful thing for our community. Let's see how what happens within the modest fashion space. I assume and I anticipate a lot of new brands to crop up and a lot of old brands to die. Just the cyclical nature of things. Like, we're in a transition period where thing like the old is not going to work anymore and the new has to come in. And I don't specifically mean old brands versus new brands. What I mean is old ways of doing things. And if people are holding on to the old ways of doing things, you will not survive. You have to learn how to adapt. And the strongest of us who will continue on will learn how to adapt and figure stuff out in this new world that we're moving into. So, and that I think is in every industry and in every vertical. That's just how it in entertainment. Look what's happening with movies and TV. Like, you have to learn how to adapt. Otherwise, you will not survive. And so, yeah, I think for us, I'm really excited to continue where we left off, which was continue to build and expand globally. Our plans of exactly how we're going to do that have changed, certainly, but the vision has not. The vision is still intact of let's get as many women who want this brand in their hands as easy as possible.
That's great. That's exciting. I'm looking forward to your success.
Thank
Literally, I am. So I really, may Allah bless you and keep you safe
very much.
and profitable. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Halal Money Matters. If you like what you hear, please do rate us on the app stores and also leave us a review. It helps other people find us a lot easier.
The thoughts and opinions expressed on Halal Money Matters do not necessarily reflect the views of Saturna Capital, Amana Mutual Funds, or their affiliates. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information about the Amana Funds in a current prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please read the prospectus or summary prospectus carefully before investing. The Amana Funds are distributed by Saturna Brokerage Services, member FINRA and SIPC, and a wholly owned subsidiary of Saturna Capital, the investment advisor to the Amana Funds. Investing involves risk, including the risk that you could lose money. The Amana Funds restrict investments to those companies consistent with Islamic and sustainable principles, which limits opportunities and may affect performance. This material is for general information only and is not a research report or commentary on any investment products offered by Saturna Capital. This material should not be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any security in any jurisdiction where such an offer or solicitation would be illegal. We do not provide tax, accounting, or legal advice to our clients, and all investors are advised to consult with their tax, accounting, or legal advisors regarding any potential investment. Investors should not assume that investments in the securities and/or sectors described were or will be profitable. This podcast is prepared based on information Saturna Capital deems reliable. However, Saturna Capital does not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the information. Investors should consult with a financial advisor prior to making an investment decision. The views and information discussed in this commentary are at a specific point in time, are subject to change, and may not reflect the views of the firm as a whole. All material presented in this publication, unless specifically indicated otherwise, is under copyright to Saturna. No part of this publication may be altered in any way, copied or distributed without the prior express written permission of Saturna Capital.